I'm really excited to be here with three fantastic people who I'd only met one of them before. And it's great to have Olivia King Star here and Takalit Partridge and Ian Kamal here. I could have only dreamt that they would have all said yes and all be here now. And so thank you so much. You wouldn't believe how grateful I am that you actually took this on. So this is a kind of differently organized session slash shift where it's part performance and part discussion. And audience interaction is greatly appreciated. And I think, Jim, you're going to do a performance for us. You know, you signed. So well, I just want to give the title of the session again, Hailing All Publics, Spoken Word and Urban Storytelling. And the whole premise of this session is, for me at any rate, at what point do cultures meet, and at what point do we establish a common ground, and what's the relationship between our own space and our public space. I'm very interested in the medium of spoken word and storytelling, and I'm going to start, and actually didn't decide on an order, with performances, and then we'll go into discussion, and then we'll do more performance, and we'll see this as a conversation that builds over the course of the next hour or so. Do I have any volunteers for the three of you to go first?
I can
first. All right.
Hi. How are you guys doing? I am a new kind of human being, consumed with seeing myself in a new light and trying to do right. In the sight of the righteous one, undefined but alive as the rising sun. And living from the heart in the darkest of skin, like targets we are, the harvest begins, the hardest of roads we walk, untraveled. The way we made the world it unraveled, so now the balance is skewed. We were fooled like lambs to the slaughter, plans for a daughter unwed, a raging, a marriage of the dead, and I can't seem to get your thoughts out of my head. I'll evolve and transform like storm clouds changing to blue skies, true lies, why, how amazing, and I'm waiting on a change to come, chasing dreams in the meantime and seeing the sun. I've been described as a Renaissance man in a house on sand, unstable, unable to walk on hands and knees. I'm crawling like infants bawling. The world keeps calling. I feel like falling. Flies on our cheeks and we're dying on the streets like vermin. The sermon and the truth don't meet. And the youth don't speak because they've never been spoken to. And we wonder why their spirit's so broken. Closed minds open, but nothing gets through. We worship tradition, so nothing is new. Like under the sun, life under the gun, fight until we've won, our world's undone. But if the war comes, we don't plan to show up. It's hard to be a man like Pan, scared to grow up. Too many lost boys seeing their end, they don't care where they're led by their fair weather friends.
I'll talk about, where I see us right now, especially with young people, is so much access to pornography through the internet that our spirits, especially with kids' spirits are kind of following what they see too much. So I've been working on a hip-hop concept about sex from a woman's perspective. Mm-hmm. And I'll stand too. Touch the back of my legs, baby. That's like an unknown secret from forgotten centuries. And flip me over, kiss my ankles, wrap your hands around me, and tiny and fragile. This is where the ground pushes up into me, and if you start there, you unlock creek beds in history. Now use your mouth, use curious hands that cruising on slow. That's the master plan. Kiss it. Kiss it all around before you go downtown. Kiss it. Kiss it all around before you go downtown. Kiss it. Kiss it all around before you go downtown. Kiss it. Kiss it all around and around and around and around. And put your hands all up
over my back, kiss the small of my neck, give me a heart attack. Let's get the blood and juice pumping real strong. Most men rush things, I get it wrong. What would be right would be the flow slowing light, cause the back of the thighs is like a sensuous sight, and mine's like a prairie honey, golden, golden brown. Take your time there, boy, slow it down and kiss it. Kiss it all around, kiss it all around before you go downtown. Kiss it. Kiss it all around, kiss it all around before you go downtown. Kiss it. Kiss it all around, kiss it all around before you go downtown. Kiss it. Kiss it all around and around and around and around. And now that you took your time like a philosopher, I'm out of my mind and you hear me like a river. You flow strong, you feel decades long, and my grip is so tight, I'm like a Tupac song. And then we rise like a landslide, roots collide. Old growth cedar welling up in our eyes, yeah, we rise like a landslide, roots collide. Old growth cedar welling up in our eyes because you kissed it. You kissed it all around, you kissed it all around before you go downtown. Kissed it. You kissed it all around, you kissed it all around before you went downtown. You kissed it. You kissed it all around, you kissed it all around before you went downtown. You kissed it. You kissed it all around and around and around and around.
Thanks, Amelia. You want to read?
Well, it's because you said urban. What was the title again?
Hailing All Publics, Urban Storytime and Spoken Word.
Well, the one that I was going to do, it's not really about urban.
That, I was thinking about that. I was thinking about that. That's okay.
Okay. I'm just going to say.
Okay.
Okay. It's called After an Argument. What can I tell you? I picked berries, buckets and buckets. Sucked up purple berry juice on my lips like lipstick and started one match fires for two for me and my sister. Dressed in mother hovered flower print carpets and our only itching close skulls were with black flies and horse flies and mosquitoes like hovering schools of fishes. We could have scooped up enough of this soup. You'll want to know the tundra is one big tiring mattress to walk on with sloping stone breaks and much to stick even hip-like boots and pools, deep and cool, by boulders spotted with orange, yellow, black, white, and light green lichen. I can tell you the flowers are many and minuscule and plants tend to taste bigger than they look. Like roots we dug by rocks and ate with grit of sand and smelling metallic. Or I can tell you fish stories. From every point I ever cast a sylvie mirror to sing in char or trout or salmon, the small ones not caught in Norman's net, who went out at low tide with mending line to square up holes and came back with legendary catch of 4-foot fish and no proof left but bones after supper. Even those the dogs might have choked down hacking ropes. I can tell you how we sat low in canoes or slept curved against the hull of a peterhead on long trips up or down the river or out into the bay, where the boy at the prow was a spring and a watchdog looking for rocks to guard against and scraping oars on loadside, calling up seals. Rifles raised and ears ringing as bullets flying by, but we were never afraid. Bobbing on waves and peeing in pots with stars and aurora overhead, heading home after weeks and weeks away from town and clocks and telephones and mirrors and everything. Everything tasted so good boiled over blue flame cold stove. I'll give you me at my Uncle Jacob's camp, a perfect place for us to pick seaweed and sea shrimp, swimming in small, salty pools, where across the inlet he shot a caribou and let it down gentle, with knife in nape of neck, where we came to fetch fresh water and wash our hair glossy, be soapy and neat. I can tell you how quiet is not silent, but yields to gentler sounds, like my Aunt Leah cleaning eiderdown and scraping fat off the sealskin as I watch. Calmed after a bit of a tiff over my brother gone hunting with the men. She made manic and called me panic daughter, and I was appeased.
First thing that strikes me is how each of you created a very different space by a different approach to your practice. And I know I said I could start off by saying, when did you start doing spoken word and all of that, but I can't help but ask, like, just the kind of energy that you bring, or the speed at which each of you work is quite different. Do you think that that speed, or that, I'm not describing it quite rightly, that it's almost like the manner in which you do your performance, is that something that you thought a lot about, or is it just something that's indicative of your personality, or how do you think about that, or do you have different modes of delivering your material?
I think it depends on sometimes who your audience is. I come from doing hip hop music, where it's like trying to cut through all everything else that's like happening around you. And I guess like the era of hip hop that I came up in, it was a lot about wordplay and like how you could create patterns in your words that people would recognize, and that those patterns sometimes actually didn't make any sense, but the people that were the best at it in the patterns that they created also had a lot of content or metaphor and simile in what it was that they were communicating to people. But a lot of hip hop is kind of about, it's about urgency, you know. And if you have a situation where you have, you know, 200, 300 people in front of you, that sort of thing, they're looking to kind of connect sometimes with that urgency. But there was also a point where I switched from doing hip-hop because it got, at a time, it got boring to me. And I went into doing, quote-unquote, spoken word, which I don't even necessarily consider that I do.
Right.
And just took the music out of what I was writing in songs and did it without any accompaniment. And
right.
And people began to say, oh, you're a poet. But there was no separation in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, then I became a poet or a spoken word artist or whatever you call it. But I still, but I come from that kind of hip hop aesthetic, and there's a lot about that. It's about urgency.
Right. Is it the urgency to connect and to unify?
No, it's just urgency. Sometimes it's to connect. I mean, hip-hop, like a lot of other forms, if you look at, like, blues, jazz, a lot of black forms of music, black American specifically forms of music, and even if you go and, you know, speak about, you know, South African praise poetry or the West African griot tradition, a lot of it was about creative artistic competition, you know, and that people like trying to outdo each other in various different kinds of ways, you know, and oftentimes like through improvisation and that sort of thing. And hip hop was no different to those other traditions, you know. And so sometimes the urgency was about an issue, and sometimes the urgency was about you being in this space trying to be better than the next person, or trying to get the MC in hip-hop, what's called an MC in hip-hop that a lot of people describe as a rapper or whatever, is literally from the term that we all understand, MC, master of ceremonies, who is the person who got control of the audience in one way and directed their attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so the person who is best at directing the audience's attention, they would be the best at doing that thing. And so that urgency sometimes came out of, if you just look at like the actual history of hip-hop music as well, similar to blues and jazz and etc., you see that competition, like competition for the attention of the audience.
Right.
And that, at a certain point, translated into an urgency around a political thing or something that happened in the neighborhood or that sort of thing. Or just blatant attention sometimes, which you see a lot in hip-hop these days, right?
Right.
But it stems from that thing.
That helps me actually understand in a different way, as opposed to imagining that it's a commercial drive. I mean, it is that too, the whole hip-hop or rap industry, let's say, music industry, but you help me see it from a different way. And it makes me think of something that you were talking about at lunch, and Alita, you were saying that in schools, you're pointing attention to students, young students of Run DMC, some older rappers and so on. Do you see that as a way of making sure that the commercialization is kind of pulled away from what they're maybe into at the moment? That they begin to think critically about what words are being used? And
To answer your question directly, I work with kids as much as possible. I teach literacy through hip-hop and do mentorship through hip-hop. And for me, hip-hop was always about people's stories. And so when I, because I'm from an older generation of hip-hop, and the stuff that I like, when I go to work with kids, I try and turn them on to the concept of just, you know, telling stories from your perspective and being as specific as you can with your words to tell your story as tight as it can be and as funny or rebellious, maybe, or pointed, because obviously we know that so many kids are hooked on mass media culture that it's one of the things that I can offer as a storyteller. And I don't really see a distinction between hip-hop, poetry, and storytelling, because you kind of have to be able to do it all if you want to be able to hold your ground in hip-hop circles. You want to be able to rap hard without music or with music. And am I answering your question or rambling?
No, perfect. It's probably by chance that I got the sense that Ian, yours was kind of to a bigger audience, and Alia and Kakare, it was to it was really personal. But that's just, I'm guessing that's just by chance that it looked up that way. Or is there a difference between women and men in this meeting?
I guess like what Ian said about like being considered a spoken word artist. Like, me, I just started because I was writing and I was finding that what I was writing on paper didn't look so nice on paper. Like, it's just something that I more wanted to say. And then I didn't even know like what so-called spoken word was. I never heard that. And then when I was exposed to it, I was like, wow, I want to try.
Yeah.
But as far as women versus men, I don't think so.
Right, and you kind of answered that, didn't you, Alita, that you have to be able to rap hard.
Yeah, I mean, 10 years ago there wasn't very many women in hip-hop. There's more women now. 15 years ago there was very, very few women doing it. There was like a movement, like there was some graffiti artists that were women, but it was more... There were more men than women, and it's still disproportionate. The music industry is a boys' club, and we don't have to like make that statement flowery.
No.
That's just the way it is, but that doesn't mean that that women aren't telling their stories really well. It just means we're fewer, which is the more reason to be more articulate or to attempt to do so.
What happens to your work when it gets recorded? I mean, what's the difference for you between doing it live or for people hearing it recorded?
Can you elaborate on your question?
Yeah. Because I figured that part of the important aspect, at least for me, even in seeing what you're doing right now, is the bodily interaction that, you know, I'm sharing your space, I'm in the room with you, there's a theatrical dimension that you give a lot of clues or information physically that gets lost on either the video recording. And that's, I would have thought that's significant, at least for me, because then in this situation I can own it or I can embody it myself, whereas if it's a recording, would I engage with it at such a profound level?
I think that would depend on the quality of the recording. Because there are some recordings that are, like, it can be hard to catch poetry and to catch music properly, but, I don't know if I can answer that question very well.
Can I answer it for you?
Yeah, please.
Well, I would be answering it for you, but in parallel. The first time I heard your work was through recording. I was blown away. I only saw you years later. So, and it was such a delight to see you years later. I'm sorry I came in late, so I missed the intro that happened today, but it's fun to hear you all speak. But so there is something to what you're saying, to seeing someone live, for sure.
Yeah.
But there's power in the spoken word, even if it's on a recording and you're not seeing the person. If they're really in the work, you feel them in the work, and it can have extreme impact.
Great.
That's a part, to sort of, from
that
my
helps.
Perspective of audience.
I think it's more like the translation of that live feel or the personal interaction that is more difficult in a recording. It's not impossible, and you can get the same feeling, but it's, to me, it's to me, recording is almost more like acting, sometimes.
Right.
Because I have the ability to be like, I don't like how I did this, I'm going to go back and do it again. And once you've done it once, and you've expressed the emotion or whatever, the first time around, every time after that, it's like I'm trying to recapture that thing, which is, to me, is kind of like acting.
Right.
You know? Right. Whereas in this situation, if I mess up, I just have to be like, okay, I messed up, and I continue to go. If I didn't feel that, if I don't feel very, very good, like if I'm walking in here, I'm tired, I'm sick, that's also going to translate into whatever I'm doing live. Where if I'm tired and I'm sick and I'm going to record, I'm probably just not going to record.
Right.
Or not keep that thing. But however I feel is going to translate into the people that are around, right?
Right. Right. And we were talking earlier about content. You asked me about whether we talk about content. Do you have a specific topic that you try to address with urgency in your work, or this is for all three of you too. I mean, is there? I guess the direct question is: do you see your work as activist? I mean, that tends to not be a popular term quite anymore, or a term that's been jaded. But can you comment on that?
I can say that I was terrified of performing, especially in front of Ire, when I first started, like, not Ire, no problem. You know, like, but Ire, even still, because what I read about is about Ire and about the North and about people living in the city, and, like, I try not to pass judgment. Well, I feel that I don't, but I just talk about stuff.
Right.
Like the one that I did just now was like tame and, you know, beautiful landscape kind of thing. But I don't normally write about that. That's just something that kind of came up when I was thinking about summer in the North. I don't know about activists. I just think that any kind of art is a medium for people to start discussions, especially amongst themselves. I think that's the the thing that I want to see for Inuit. I feel like my whole life is, it's not that I'm an activist, but like my whole life is around Inuit and about Inuit and about, you know, being a member of that community. And there's things that I would like to see change, but I'm not saying that I have any hand in that. It's just that I like to talk about it.
Right. Right. And it's interesting the pressure that you feel if your audience is in. And what have the responses been to you?
For the most part, it's been pretty positive. And also, what the heck are you doing that in English?
Right.
Or what the heck is that you're doing anyway? Like, it's not, you know, like the kids back home, they're into gangster rap.
Yeah.
You know, which this is, like, totally not that. So, like, they're, you know, doing, like, trying to do rap and even to do.
Right.
But it's all about, you know, drugs and money and whatever. But, as I say, doing something, right? But, also, but I have had a few people say, like, how could you say that? Like, even stuff, like, I did, like, I do some stuff that's kind of satirical. And I had written a piece that was very satirical and not meant to be in any way mean, though. And it was just about Inuit and living in the city and things that we do, like shopping at Walmart, you know, like, and when our relatives come to town, you better make sure that your car is empty so you can go to Walmart and get a whole bunch of crap, you know, like,
yay.
Just stuff like that, and people were so insulted, like, some people that I run into in the grocery store still won't speak to me, because of the Walmart or the Costco or the whatever it was.
Right, yeah. Oh, well, is it, so there's not a lot of sense, though, that you're picking up on a tradition of storytelling, or...?
I would say not, although that's something that people like to put in my bio when I do geeks.
Yeah, right.
Although, except I can say that the idea of doing things in a spoken manner, I suppose.
Right.
As opposed to having them on paper. I think, like, one of my favorite... authors is Sherman Alexie. He's a Native American author from Washington State. And he's a little bit controversial in Native circles, but there's something about his writing that I really like. And I was reading a transcript of an interview that he had done, I think, and he was talking about, or also it was some kind of article about how when he writes, he has to read his short stories a lot because he feels that they have to sound good spoken. And I think that's what really attracted me to his writing, is that it has that quality of being able to be spoken out loud. I feel like the best way for a story to be heard is from the mouth of the person who's created it, as opposed to just some piece of paper.
Right. And your comments raise a question immediately for me about, like, who would be your preferred audience, and or do you have an audience preference, and how much your audience affects what you decide to perform and how you perform it. There's too many questions in there. But is there a preferred audience for each of you? I mean, your ideal scenario. I know it's this one here right now. Perfect.
Listeners,
right.
Yeah. I've been, especially because of, like, doing hip-hop, you get put in situations sometimes that are not necessarily like this, you know, where it's like people are there and they quietly listen, and they don't like you, they keep that to themselves, and they talk about it after, but they're not going to be like,
yeah.
Or leave or talk to their friend or something like that, and you know, and so... Yeah, I mean, my preferred audience is people that are wanting to engage with what it is that I'm trying at least to do. Because, like, I view this sort of thing as the beginning of conversations. And so if that means that means it's at some point in time someone has to make some greeting or make some statement that is going to be the beginning of the conversation.
Right.
And so that's the kind of audience that I prefer to have, people that are actually going to engage with it. It doesn't have to be positively, but are going to engage with it. That'll come, that'll actually sit down and listen to you, and then come up to you after and be like, I completely disagree with what you said, and this is why.
Yeah.
To me, that's really where the excitement of doing this sort of thing comes.
Right.
And I've made a lot of friends in that way.
Eating on the disagreement.
Yeah, because that's the best kind of conversation.
Yeah. I like it when everybody agrees with me. It's easier. No. I can open this out to anybody who wants to ask questions, so please interject if there's something you want to say. Alia, where did you start doing poetry?
Well, my previous art background was with visual arts and I was stenciling shirts for punk rock bands and putting up pieces of art on walls. And that's when I started to rap, because I was just doing it. When I was working, I was always rapping. And then I thought maybe there was something to that. But that was in 96, 97. That's when I started doing music professionally, like in public. But I just wanted to say that I wanted to follow what you said, which is, the first time I performed in front of, like on a Mohawk reserve, on the Wada reserve, I couldn't stop crying before I played. I mean, it was just, I think that's the first time I met you, maybe, on, at Sweetwater.
Yeah, that was.
Was that the first time we met?
I think so, yeah.
And I was, like, before the show, like, I'd played in front of Native audiences before, and I had there's a similar feeling of, because I'm mixed, so when I'm around Native people, it feels like my body's actually being pulled open, because I didn't grow up around a lot of Native people, so when I started to be more around other Indian people, I had a feeling that I was being really opened. And the feeling that I had the first time playing on a Mohawk reserve was unbearable. I was crying and crying and crying. It felt like my chest was being, like my heart and my bones and stuff were pulling apart. It was so amazing. And since then, that feeling is something that I've heard described in different ways. But for me, that's kind of the essence of art making. And that's when I know that I'm doing something right, is when I'm so totally outside my comfort zone and so incredibly, incredibly ill at ease. And I don't know why I wanted to say that, but I think for me that's just that's the reason why I keep going back to making art. Making music, and it's because of that feeling, like when you know that something's going on inside you. And it's funny because I noticed that people look to artists, and people also sometimes come to me, they say that they want an answer to a question, but for me, art making is actually me asking my questions and learning about myself. So I present. As a performer, you try to present yourself as someone who's sort of together because you want to be professional.
Mm-hmm.
But really, every time I'm getting somewhere, it's when I'm actually becoming really, really uncomfortable and asking really, really hard questions. And for me, those questions are race and sex.
Right.
And those come up through family and history. And,
Well, I have to say that, you know, from my perspective, you know, there's those questions that are really uncomfortable, but also even the situation where, you know, there's a few people in a room and you have to get up and there's no other accompaniment, nothing, and do the piece, that's got to be one of the hardest things to do. And not mess up, right?
Yeah.
Or mess up.
your what you just said just gets us back to the content side of your work again. So have you seen a change in those weren't the questions you started out with when you began work, or do those questions feed you for decades, do you suppose, or how does it, what's happened in three of your careers so far in terms of, I mean, can you, the pieces that you just did, are they from last week or 10 years ago, or do they evolve, or, again, I'm asking too many questions, let me start with that again. Do you find that the work you wrote 10 years ago is still on track with where you're taking your thinking?
Yeah, and I feel like a broken record because I've witnessed my aunties and my grandparents too, who are mixed as well. I've witnessed them going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. I'm white. I'm native. I'm white. I'm native. It changes every year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's, like, for people who are mixed race, I don't anticipate one day that I'm just all of a sudden going to be, like, to have everything figured out. No.
Right.
It feels like the same. And actually, I have, my mom has poems from me that I wrote when I was, like, 6 and 8, and I'm already talking about that.
Right. Right.
So I think, like, sometimes I feel like I follow my life path. And that's one of my questions that I'm always going to be asking.
Right.
And looking for the answer to. And that makes me sad. Because I feel like I'm never going to have any answers.
Yeah.
But it also, I know that I share that with so many Canadians because there's so many of us that are mixed. And especially Native people because we're basically invisible.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're not Indian enough to be Indian, you're not white enough to be white. So just tell people you're Italian. That thing, like, that's tiring, right? Like, it gets exhausting sometimes, but then I'm happy that I'm asking the questions because my brothers feel silent, and they don't ask them.
Hmm.
They just, they're like, oh, our sister will ask them.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah.
I hope I answered.
Yeah. Oh, incredible. And tackling it for you, is it a lot of the North South then?
Okay, I didn't write 10 years ago.
Okay.
I started writing 6 years ago. what it comes out,
right?
It's always about me. But you know, like the one that I did. I was thinking about growing up in the North. The reason I started writing this because I had been living in the South. I came down for school. I ended up having my twins. Ended up getting married with somebody who would not have ever lived in the North. And I always thought I was in the South temporarily.
Uh-huh.
I always felt like, it's like when you move from the North to the South, it's like you're an immigrant, the same. Like you're from a totally different world. And I was just feeling so sick of the city.
Yeah.
Feeling like I'm just, you know, in a foreign place all the time, and feeling like I needed to have some way to talk about that. And I always really liked writing, but I never did anything because I didn't think I had anything to say. But then I just, you know, like when you have to create something, when you've got something coming out of you, you just have to do it or else you're going to do something really, something horrible is going to happen. So, yeah, I started writing a lot about Inuit in the South, or my life in the South, or stuff in the North. It's all pretty much about that. I moved on to trying to write short stories. We'll see where that goes. And I confess that I'm kind of obsessed with The New Yorker.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm trying to read stories in there and think about, what is it about these stories that are, you know, somewhat generic and appealing to a broad audience that I can't tap into. I kind of think I don't have that.
And what about you, Ian? I mean, do you see yourself straddling worlds or in between? Or?
Yeah, I think we all do that.
Yeah.
In one way or another. So.
Is it fundamentally the public and private self, or?
It's the public and private self. It's this thing called double consciousness, I guess, if you're someone outside of the mainstream of society.
I think what's predominantly changed for me over the years has just been my level of honesty.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the topic or what I write about has always been about me. As what I understood to be me also had to do with the people that were around me, had to do with the people that I came from, had to do with the people they came from, the people, you know, I've lived in downtown Toronto for entire life, so it's a lot of different kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different types of experiences, and so predominantly what has changed is my level of honesty in outwardly expressing what I was actually thinking. Where there are things that I probably wouldn't say when I've been writing for a long time. So when I was 16, because I was incredibly insecure. You know,
right.
So I just like, as a teenage boy going to high school, you're not necessarily going to talk a lot about your feelings and that sort of thing.
Right.
At least in my experience.
Right.
And so as I've got older, it's just been more about expressing what I actually feel.
Right.
Like if I'm hurt, to say that I'm hurt. You know, if I feel angry, to say that I'm angry.
Right.
You know. And so the piece that I did today was kind of an older piece.
Right.
It was kind of like stream of consciousness, kind of about the variety. You can catch things, but it's not like there is a through line or a storyline or something that was necessarily personal to me, like very personal to me. It was more general. Thing, you know?
Right, and I was wondering about that actually, because it felt to me that it was about more generally fear.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be fair to say?
I don't know if it's fear. I think a lot of what I talk about is oppression, because that scares me.
Yeah.
And it scares me that people don't recognize their own oppression or their own oppressive tendencies on both sides, which makes the world continue as it is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't notice how much I'm being oppressed or am being oppressive in whatever position I'm in, and that person that I view as an oppressive force also has those elements in their life, and they don't recognize those things as well, and so we all stay still.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that honesty, if that's honesty around personal things or political things or social things or
mm-hmm.
that sort of stuff, because I find like it's difficult. I think it's difficult to be honest more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But people appreciate it because it is difficult. And because fundamentally, almost everybody kind of goes through the same things in one way or another. And so I've had a lot of the same kind of experiences in terms of people coming up. I recognize very clearly that there is a point between people coming up and saying, oh, you're really good, or you're dope, or you're that sort of thing. I like there's literally a line to when I started doing things in a different way, because I also kind of made a conscious decision to just be like, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to do whatever I feel like doing, no matter how vulnerable I make myself or that sort of thing. There was a clear line between people coming up to me and shaking my hand or saying, I was really good or something like that, and people coming up and saying, like, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which was a surprise to me.
Yeah.
It tripped me out. I had a bunch of people coming up to me, pull me into a corner and like cry, and all that sort of stuff. Huh? Yeah, actually, on a couple of occasions.
Yeah.
Because I also, I'll probably do something after, but I talk a lot about stuff that men also go through that don't necessarily express those things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, we, men have the same feelings that women have. We just tend to, the society and our upbringing and that sort of thing just makes us repress those things a lot more and not communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a stereotype of what a male is and what a male can and cannot do. In the same way that there's the same stereotypes about women, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's been kind of interesting when someone that you view as like a certain kind of male
mm-hmm.
comes up to you with tears welling up in his eyes, like, I really felt what you were saying, and this is why.
And you have to hold yourself back and think they're an idiot. You know, I can see that. I'm kidding, right? But it's funny because all of a sudden somebody is really vulnerable in front of you. And then, oh, you know, so you have to catch yourself from somebody making a judgment about them too.
No, not even because it's honest.
Right. And I think, I don't want to carry on too long because I know you wanted to ask a question. But can I ask for a quick thing?
Can I just ask?
Yeah.
Because the thing about when you, I find like the best work that people do, it kind of comes out of you and then it's not really you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's like what he's talking about, people come out like, I go on about this, but now he's sitting next to me, so this is so bad. The reason I started on Spokeboard was because of Ian. And I heard him on an album and I was just blown away. I was like, what is that? And I had a CD player in the car and rewinding on that. What is that thing that he's doing? And then, so then I Googled him and I couldn't find anything. And then I finally found this show that he was part of this book release and I came to see him. And I just had to tell him, like, you really woke, just had to meet him, like, that he really woke something, his work woke something up in me that had me start on this other path of, you know, whatever it is I've come to now. And I've since had similar experience on the receiving end where people have told me stuff that they're so inspired or whatever, and I'm just kind of, I don't know what to do with that. So I look back on that and I think when I went to meet him and say, you know, wow, you're so amazing. The poor guy, that he didn't run away screaming. I have to give him credit.
She's like, I drove all the way from where?
I drove from Montreal.
You drove all the way from Montreal?
I packed all the kids up. I sent them to my sister was living in Kitchener. I put the kids there. And then I went with my other sister to go see him. And like I was saying, Kaon was playing that night. It was a free show. And I had the ticket for that too, but I was only interested in seeing
him.
So, but that was seriously, that was a big moment in my life. And, you know, like not to weird Ian out, it's just that his work, however it came out of him, was something that sparked something else.
And the honesty, it's obviously we just don't do enough talking, right? Generally speaking, So that would be the, I mean, I'm not trying to put labels on it or put it in a corner and see it like that, but is that kind of an overarching agenda though? It is about getting people to discuss or getting people to think about.
Yeah, well, I think that, to me that's the only purpose in doing any form of art. I recognize like art for art's sake.
Right.
But me personally, I just feel like there has to be something in what you're doing.
Right.
There has to be some, why would I just sit here and talk to people without saying anything?
Right.
You know, you have to say something. It doesn't even have to be in words, but you have to say something.
Right.
And that's why I call it like the way, the craft of putting anything together, a piece of art together, a spoken word piece, a song, a picture, theater, whatever. The craft of doing that is about how you communicate whatever the message is, or the underlying, or like whatever the underlying the thing that you're trying to communicate or the conversation that you're trying to start. And everything else is how you deliver that message. So if I have, the new pair of jeans, which I need, and I need to get it, to from OCAD to my place in Esplanade, I need to figure out somehow how I get that pair of jeans from here to there. And there are a million different ways to do that.
Yeah.
But the jeans remain the same, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's really about how you're communicating that thing and what's the best way. If I was in a, you know, if I was in more of a hip-hop context, this might not be the best avenue for me to communicate my point. And I can communicate my point here as well in a certain way, but I'm not going to be standing on the corner in my neighborhood speaking in this same kind of way. You know, I might be saying the same things, but the mode in which I transport that information becomes different if I'm talking to a guy who's standing on the corner in my neighborhood, or if I'm, you know, talking to a room full of artists and academics.
Right. Well, this is interesting, because I mean, you know, my question has to do with the context in which you perform, because this is a particular wonderful, intimate sort of circle, and I've really enjoyed hearing all of you. And they're all such affecting performances in their own way and very distinct. But could you talk a little bit about the range of places that you have performed? Because I'm not quite sure where to find you if I were to want to see you again. And like, where would you, you know, what just like the just the most diverse context, maybe if just you could just indicate a few on the continuum of your performing context. You've talked about your speaking to, you know, people, First Nations people, and how that affected you, but just where did that happen? That sort of thing.
I like to play festivals whenever possible, but I don't often get into festivals, but I really like that. And I have a booking agent that books me for smaller shows and bigger shows, opening for bands, sometimes doing my own shows. I don't actually play out enough, probably, because I don't love that. I love writing. So, I don't really know the answer, like...
No, it's not one right answer. An image in a way, just to imagine you someplace.
Well, yeah. I like doing soft cedar venues, too, which is for the same reason that Ian was talking about, like, where there's listeners. So that's my preference over, like a bar on a Friday night where everybody's like, woo! But I can do that too and just like do hip hop and get people dancing, but I also really love environments like this. Where have I performed or what do I prefer?
Maybe you can talk about the Montreal group that you've done. I forgot the name of it, it is the poetry group that you're part of and Montreal?
There's a bunch of different stuff going on with poetry in Montreal. But there's this show called Words and Music that happens every month. And sometimes I perform there.
Is it a show that's like a live show or a radio show or
it's a live show.
Live show.
Yeah.
Okay.
All over the place.
Okay.
I enjoy less now I get older, but I enjoy turning people around who have no idea of who I am. Right? Like we're just some guy walks in a hoodie and a pair of jeans, and there are assumptions that come about that, and I like being able to go into a situation and turn people's heads around. So, but I performed, in Toronto, you know, venues, clubs, that sort of thing. I performed in slums in East Africa, in South Africa. I performed in a prison once in Rio de Janeiro, which was crazy. Like, in the cell, of a prison with like they put the rival gangs in cells next to each other, separate.
Oh,
and there was like a grate or something where there's a guard or a couple of guards with like AK-47s walking above. And I went to do this like exchange kind of program because I do community work or whatever in the day. And so we visited all the different projects and things with, you know, different people. Mm-hmm. And one of the people worked in the jails. And so he was like, I do this program in this jail in Rio, we should go check it out. And they just put us in a cell with about 40, 50 guys. And someone was just like, he performs. You know, so I stood on a bench in the middle of this, it's not like I've been inside of jails here too.
Yeah.
And the jails in Rio de Janeiro are a completely different situation,
yeah.
You know. So I performed in, you know, Cuba, a lot of hip-hop festivals or spoken word festivals, all over Canada and a variety of different things. And then just, you know, because I feel like hip-hop especially is a very interactive, kind of grassroots type of thing, I've performed, quote-unquote, in a lot of alleyways. And basements, and street corners, and wherever, you know. I performed in front of groups of three people, I performed in front of audiences of 5,000 people, you know. I think the thing that really changes how you perform, sometimes is your audience, but if you're honest and you're direct, and there's something about your mode of communication that people have to at least pay attention to get to the point of understanding what your content is, you know, you can get the attention of anybody. Sometimes it's more difficult to get the attention of 30 kids in a high school classroom than it is to get the attention of 5,000 people at Brixton Academy.
We know that. No, we don't know that. We know that in that classroom. No, that's...
I feel like there might be another performance coming along. I don't know how you feel about that, but I'm wondering if you might be willing to do another piece of stuff.
Yeah.
That's
what you
want. It's a wrap, I know, but you have a squat. You don't want me to perform because I'm really not very good.
I'm ready.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Are you sure, Corey?
Okay.
So sometimes when I, no, all the time when I perform, I usually get people to say stuff back to me. Right? So I know this has been like kind of quiet, and everyone's hands are crossed. I say, oh, they're loud. I'm not going to ask you to dance or anything. But just when I say this word out loud, that you say the word back to me as loud as you can. As loud as you can.
Okay.
Say joy.
Joy.
Joy. Say joy. I've captured fragments of the globe inside my mind, fleeting moments that I hold fast to, then throw them to infinity. And every step a lesson, every breath a blessing, each confession saves a second of the time that's slowly killing me. Inside these sentences, the place where my repentance is, I'm so afraid and trying to turn these exits into entrances. I've taken all of what I had and scratched it down onto a pad that never saw the light of day, hence the tension is rising up inside of me, crying for those that died for me, my true friends. But it seems a selfish and biting me. They talk, but they aren't listening. Say joy.
Joy.
Say joy.
Joy.
Say joy.
Joy.
Say joy.
Joy.
See? The other thing is, too, I like going into situations. I used to be very nervous about messing up. You talk, like, about messing up. And that's another thing that I don't care about anymore. Right? You're a human being, everybody messes up, get over it. So, this one's a little more serious. In the shadow of the gun, the unsung live away from the sun. The river of peace, it's often the shallowest one. Though once some hung the silence, our voices, violence and riots for the night, and our choices, never choices for black boys to fall like rain. Bullets make a body fold like paper cranes. Our lives at a time, both sacred and profane, and black folk, we're selling black folk crack cocaine. And the business is good, customers, they come to visit if you live in the hood. So now we love the ghetto, we believe it's our home, the streets are our kingdom, the corner of our throne. We're like flies in the fibers of spiders' webs, trapped, taking orders like Simon says. We no longer court the truth, but seek a bullet instead, because the world barely cares if we're alive or dead. Like stakes in the heart, bullets like bats tend to fly after dark, but we make sure our children are home from the park of shame. Every day another name to discuss flood the streets with their guns, and they blame it on us. Always at the back of their buses, they say, Jay made the front page after Boxing Day. These guns, you can get them off the streets or the shelves, so the youth, they make the purchase to protect themselves. Parents unaware of what the new reality is, tragically a catastrophe where families live. And many black boys becoming men on their own. You win the lottery if you got a father at home. So we find the wrong influence looking for that father figure. Don't see the irony in why we call each other nigger. Don't see the irony in why we call each other nigger.
Why not find both sides of the trigger?
Standing in wonder under the cover of the sun. Listen to the distant thunder of the summer of the gun. But the truth right in front of our eyes, we don't see it. That's why these young brothers say peace, but don't mean it. Fighting wars unaware of what we're dying for. Foolish, the streets, they ain't mine or yours. So we cry and say goodbye to the lives we know. It's as fast as they come, they go. Like playing with flame, kids are killers now. They're making a name, only some of our community is taking the blame. Though the killer knows the blame is essentially his. Most folks are unaware of who the enemy is. It's distorted. Whenever a life is aborted before its time, and our kind sure can't afford it. Still it seems that the dream of the streets won't cease, but we know that blessed are those that make peace. Guns make a mockery of the life we treasure, leaving flesh twisted like treble clefs in a measure. Calling out loud, screaming love, we can't say it enough now. We're smearing our blood on the pavement, giving the same pain, making the same claims, killing to maintain, killing to maintain. Because we don't trust, we doubt first. A life without worth is prone to outbursts. So we're still dying, only the killer has changed. Africans once in the waves, the worth of a slave. Now the dope on the street is the rope on the tree, and these guns in the box kick from under our feet. The hate is not replaced, it's the fist in the fight. Respect for life is rotting before it's ripe. We didn't choose these ghettos, favelas, and slums, but it's like they made these goddamn guns with black bodies.
Got shivers after that one. Do you want to space out performances a bit rather than going one right after? Or?
Sure. Does anybody have any questions? And
maybe can
I was listening to what you said, Technic, about reading The New Yorker and obsessing about the story. That I'm sure every writer has done that. And I find that when you read something or see a performance that you may not actually want to emulate it. It's, or you may think that you never would want to or can't. That can be just as influential on you as stuff that you like. And I wondered if you could talk about basically what your influences are, but negative or positive. Like, what are the things that have, or the works or the other artists that you want to be like or don't want to be like?
Who, me?
All three of you.
Be like, I don't want to be like anybody.
Okay.
I really don't. There's some artists that I really, really admire and whose work just moves me, and then there's a lot of shit. And I don't, and part of the problem I have with spoken word, the name of it, is that there's a lot of,
I don't know, for me there's a lot of monotony that goes with that. Like sometimes people tend to get into this thing where they are talking the same way and they are not saying anything. You know, like that's not nice for me to say.
I know what you're talking about.
You know, like, and what Ian was, and Kenny was saying that about honesty, like, the for me, the work, any kind of work, and I'm not big on putting things in any specific category. It's just if something, if I like something, and if I find that it rings true for me, then it's something that I'm going to want to have more of. And then, like, the thing about Ian's work is that he's got this crazy, wonderful flow of words that play against each other back to back, but he's also got a message, which sometimes maybe I won't understand because I come from a different place, but at the same time it does talk to me. What other influences? I don't know, I just get obsessed with specific writers. Like, I'm obsessed with this Dominican-American writer right now. His name's Juno Diaz.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes in this way where his characters are a lot of times just real assholes, and you don't like them, but there's something that rings true about what he's saying, to where you think, yeah, this guy's a jerk, but I could so see that this would happen in real life. And the fact that he's talking about those things, makes me want to understand more of where he's coming from.
I love just artists. Like, really just weird. People that don't care, like, that have no blocks to what they're doing, which automatically kind of makes you separate to society, which is very, like, robotic sometimes. And so I like people that just emote, you know? And so all my reference is usually around music, and people like CeeLo Green from Goody Mob, and Gnarls Barkley, Tom York from Radiohead, Bjork, Saul Williams, Lil Wayne. Like, I listen to everything now. Like, when I was younger, I used to be very much like, I'm supposed to be doing conscious hip-hop, and so people understand that I'm going to talk about Digable Planets and Arrested Development and Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul and everything that I loved, you know, and not necessarily talk about, you know, Snoop Dogg's Doggy Style album or that sort of thing, you know? But I just really like people that are honest to themselves, and I feel like, as politically incorrect as it is for me to say, like, I enjoy the craft of Lil Wayne. So wrong.
No, it's not.
But I love his shit so much because of that. Because it's just like, this guy, you can tell this guy is just himself.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless, you can put a judgment on whether that self is good or bad or how it influences our children or anything like that. But he's just himself, you know, and I felt the same way. I feel the same way, like, watching, like, Meeting People Is Easy, that Radiohead documentary, the same kind of thing. Just like this. I think Tom York is the most arrogant, like, stuck-up, rich, snobby kid. But he just does, what he does is incredible to me, you know. And in everything, in any form of art, I enjoy, like, just watching people be themselves and let themselves go and just express whatever that is, no matter what. You know, that's why a person like John Coltrane or something is amazing, because you sit down, you watch a guy who blows air into an inanimate object of brass and metal or whatever, and makes something sound like it's human. Like, there's this all-encompassing spiritual twisted humanity, you know, people put people like that on a pedestal a lot of the time, which I don't necessarily agree with, but knowing and understanding about people's lives too, it's like, you know,
he's an amazing person, spiritually uplifting individual, and a heroin addict, and all sorts of stuff, and just put all this stuff, put all that stuff into whatever they're doing with no blocks, or as little blocks as possible. You know? That's what really influences me. And that could be just a person. That could be a guy I see on the bus who just speaks indiscriminately to people.
Do I have to say who influences me now?
Yep.
You don't have to.
I agree with everything you said. Like, authenticity in humans, like authentic humans, whether it's a gardener or like a janitor or like a mother, that is the stuff that blows me away daily. And I'm very, very interested in social history, especially turn of the century race politics in Canada. There's a time period like between 1850 and like 1920 or so that like I was like the nerd combing the archives in Toronto and Ottawa for years at a time, like looking at the microfiches before the internet. Social history fascinates me, looking at people's life stories, looking at church documentation of marriages and textiles coming in and out, the way Native people integrated European and indigenous fashion, fabrics that were used. Those are the things, unfortunately, like I'm a little bit outside, like I'm more interested in stuff like that than popular culture, but over the last 5 years, I've been really trying to advocate for popular culture. So now I like rent TV series and stuff so that I can try and be a part of the general public. I'm really trying to understand it better, popular culture, because I see that it's very important to a lot of people, and I can be a real bitch sometimes and kind of be like, oh, I don't like popular culture, but then I realize that it really is important to me. My older brother is really into popular culture, so I'm trying to become more invested in it, but still really my love is in social history and families. Like Anne-Marie McDonald's Fall on Your Knees, the story of that family. Stuff like that, both books and biographies, like Vivian Westwood's biography I just read, and the history of punk rock, and the Rocksteady movement in Jamaica happening at the same time as the punk rock movement. I love social history, I'm obsessed.
I was wondering, Alita, about your writing ritual, because I know you, that's your goal, is to be writing all the time. Is there a ritual on your day?
That's a nice question. I've trained myself to get up early. I used to be a night owl, like 3 a.m. was sort of the earliest that I went to sleep. Now it's taken me about 5 years. My investment in popular culture also came with my investment in trying to tap into mainstream mentality a bit, just so I felt like less of an outsider. So one of the things I decided to do was to wake up with the sun, also for biological reasons, because I find it gives me more energy and I'm less blue. So I try to wake up early and write. And I wake up early, write, and stretch, work out, eat, and as long as I can try and advocate, dedicate about 3 to 5 hours of writing and like eating and a little bit of movement, I'm good to go. It works for me, and I try and do it almost every day. And it makes me a little bit robotic. Like for my husband, it's just like, whoa. You need to chill out, like, you should sleep in. But I'm on a kind of a quest right now where I want to produce as much material as possible. And the way I do it is by disciplining myself. I'm very interested in systems of discipline. Internally, like, I have a meditation clock. It's like a Zen meditation clock, and it dings every... You can put it on whatever amount of time you want it on. So you could do 20-minute cycles or hour-long cycles, 15-minute cycles. And I use it as, like, a work and meditation and writing. Literally, it's like, I'm like, okay, I'm going to write for an hour. And I put the timer on. I write, ding, it goes off.
And when you're writing, I mean, is it Are you writing music or words or both or all?
Right now I'm writing blues. I'm writing blues songs for some blues artists, folk songs for folk artists, co-writes for Last Gang Records, and hip-hop for my own stuff, and an electro project, like a dance electro project, as well as a short story concept around winter coming in and watching winter come in over the lake. Because my grandfather built a place in Lake Huron 72 years ago. It was finished. And you can see if you're up there in the fall, you can watch the fall time come in and the winter time come in, and you can see the birds change and the chipmunks start to bring the packs, their little piles of stuff, and it's incredible. And I'm trying to be able to write that with more articulation and more authenticity right now. So those are my projects.
I have a question, and thank you guys so much for bringing here. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see all of you, but just being able to hear your stories and how you came about this work is really beautiful, and especially, I'm going to probably overgeneralize, but I'm coming from the U.S. and D.C., Chicago, New York, and all those different circles, and have done a lot of spoken word artistry and coaching of young people, and just the tendency, a lot of people like take up more space and speak more loud and like have this huge ego that kind of surrounds them, and I really also appreciated your humbleness and honesty, and that authentic voice, I think, really radiates and permeates even just the way that you're speaking in this space, and that's really beautiful. And some of my poetry mentors who have come to Canada have said that they've seen it as kind of a renaissance, and they've been really inspired by the spoken word scene here, that they can relate back to the early 90s of spoken word in New York, not as a way of regression at all, but in a really positive moment where before Deaf Poetry Jam, before it was all about speaking in that same cadence. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if feel like that this is a really rich time right now in Canada for spoken word, if there's those kind of international connections that you were talking about before with Cuba, and I really like that transnational flow, and I want to know what's going on.
There's a lot going on, not just in spoken word, but creatively. I mean, I can speak for Toronto because that's where I live. But creatively in Toronto right now. And a lot of young people who are getting involved in all sorts of different realms of creativity and performance, or creative performance, or some combination of those several words that I just said. I don't know what's going to happen. But there is definitely a lot of energy right now just around the creation of stuff. And there's been a lot of, as I said, in my day job is working with young people, essentially, or building an organization now. And there's been a lot of, even just money, I mean, that's flown, there's the various arts councils and that sort of thing kind of got together and decided that they wanted, for whatever space of time they decide to do that, to invest in like youth-led initiatives and that sort of stuff. And I don't trust it, but it has been creating the space for young people to be able to explore as well, and to be facilitated by people who have some experience in doing that and who can spend the time because the money is there, And a lot of those people would spend the time anyway. But it enables someone like me, let's say, to spend all your time doing that, which wasn't possible for me before. And so there is kind of a renaissance feel. I'm really about, my parents are filmmakers, they're documentary filmmakers. And so I'm really about the documenting of this now, because I feel like that's, in a lot of ways, that's the difference between the States and Canada, especially when it comes to people who did not necessarily fit what the mainstream is. Is that it's been happening for decades, maybe even for way longer than that, actually, since people got here. The question is, who deemed it valuable enough to document or not document? And that's what decides what the history is, right? And so it is and it isn't the Renaissance. You know, because my father was a writer and was a poet and a photographer, and my parents are the first black filmmakers in Canada. But nobody knows who they are, you know? And so that's part of the thing. Films exist, you can get them in any library, university, that sort of thing. And they were like the beginning of people beginning to document. I don't even want to say alternative, because everybody here, ascend in my mind, at least is part of the mainstream, just hasn't been deemed as such. But we're documenting their community. Like, you know, first generations of people that came here from the Caribbean. But there wasn't a lot of that happening. And so it does seem like a renaissance now, because we have a lot more access to people being able to just document them themselves, as opposed to waiting on, you know, $150,000 to do something. You can just go to Henry's and buy a 7D, record everything yourself, put it on the internet. And that a lot of the younger generation has been even more involved in that technique.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. I just had a question kind of going along with what you're saying about technology and how you're talking about recording and modes of communication, and sort of looking at how we have, you know, BlackBerry and iPad and Facebook and YouTube. And so do you feel that your work is in battle with that, or are you embracing the technology with your work?
You have to embrace it or you become irrelevant. Nowadays, if you don't embrace it, you don't exist.
And in what ways? Basically. Yeah. And in what ways are you embracing it? Really? Is it YouTube videos? Is it websites?
It's everything. It's everything. In the last little while, it's like I have a Facebook account, a Twitter account. MySpace is kind of dead right now, but you know, YouTube, everything. I have a blog, everything you put in there. Basically, it's like you have the ability to put everything up and for that to be public and to build a network of people around those things that you can access, you know, automatically. I never wanted to be, like, involved in the music industry because of how corrupt... I mean, everything is corrupt, but the music industry particularly is a terrible place. And that used to be the only avenue to get to a wider group of people. And now, although it takes time and that sort of thing, record companies and other sorts of companies were predominantly networks and banks. That's pretty much what they did. And so now you have the ability to, like, build up your own network and create enough interest for something that you're doing that at some point in time you can have a wider audience. So if you do go and do a show now, as opposed to me doing a show 3 years ago, there's a whole new generation of people who are interacting with what I'm doing just online. You don't know what I was doing in 1996, you know? So I think it's incredibly important to interact with those things positively and consistently, but also to lend a quality to those things. Because just because everybody can do it, yeah, you know the end of the sentence.
Yeah.
You know? And the people that use those things that can be accessed by everybody, to the best of their ability, or no, listen, I don't know how to do this, I'm going to get someone who knows how to do this really well to communicate that thing that I'm communicating in this way, because those things cut through as well. To me, those things are storytelling in the same way. Like, there is the writing of a story, or a short story, or a poem, or a song, or that sort of thing, but also these things enable you to tell your story in a certain way, and there has to be a kind of a strategy and an understanding around how and what you're communicating and what you're building up in terms of your identity in public as well. And that is kind of not missing right now, it exists right now, but that's something that's growing, you know. But yeah, I think it's incredibly important. I think I'm sorry for talking so much.
No, thank you.
But, you know, it's like at a certain point, which is hilarious to me, at a certain point, like the record companies did these commercials where they got like DMX or Shakira or someone to say like don't download.
I remember that.
You know, there's this whole like move. They spent all this money on, because
the music industry or music wasn't threatened. They were threatened,
mm-hmm.
right? And so they put this thing out. And it's funny because I was watching Style Wars the other day, and they did the same thing for Lafitte. They had all these like famous actors and whatever, the youth actors in the 80s, who did these like anti-graffiti campaigns in the exact same way that the music industry was doing these. And of course, it just, it disappeared, because it's impossible. You can't, those things move forward, they don't move backward. And so you have to embrace them and make those things what you need them to be, as opposed to saying, no, this has to stop. It's like telling people when you can still buy a cassette at HMV. It's like telling people not to dump their cassettes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really?
I wonder, I was thinking about you, Alita, as Ian was talking, and that you have an agent, and you have that professional part of your career, but yet you have this whole other side, which is, what adjective to use, but it's your own and you control it. Is that a difficult situation to manage that, those two sides? Do you wish that, is it difficult to get a good agent? Does that interfere a lot with how you want to take your career, or what happens?
No, like, I have a booking agent, they solicit me for shows, and then I have my record label at Last Gang Records, and they serve various functions, and I had a manager for 12 years, the first 12 years of my career. She was incredible. And those, all of those people, everybody, it's a team. Anytime you want to get product available, it's a team. Like, I don't have skills that a good manager has. Like, my manager for 12 years, she was an administrator and she knew how to connect people. Those are skills. And like, for instance, in terms of access to technology, I have two friends they've been my friends for 15 years. They do most of my internet stuff. So like they hooked it all up, so I do the little microblog in my Facebook status, and it goes out to Twitter, which they run, and that kind of thing. And I'm not afraid of, I've always believed that art is public. So I've never, ever been worried about people taking my words, taking my music, any of that. So I don't mind. I mean, if I didn't have a team, I wouldn't have a career.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not comfortable with the idea of, like, Kimmy Star, wow, you do everything by yourself, because I tend to get written up that way.
Right.
But, I mean, I've always had record labels and managers and booking agents and people that help me a lot, because I don't know how to do any of that.
Right.
Yeah. And I love the online, just further to that, I won't blab too much, but I wrestled with the whole idea of putting everything up online, but to me it's just like graffiti. Like, it's just like, and then, you know, it's public, people can respond, they can argue with you publicly, you can create conversations, friction. Oftentimes the friction, out of friction comes the best friendships, because you're online with your peers. Like, and mentally you're like this, and then you can grow these beautiful friendships out of that. So 2 years ago I was firmly against MySpace and all that stuff, only because I didn't know how to do it.
Right.
And now that I've learned about Facebook and the whole, you know, having a wall and responding and everything, it's like what graffiti was. Like, when I was first doing graffiti, it's like you could go back to the spot where you had put your piece up, and most of my graffiti was feminist graffiti, and so you have, like, I put this one piece of basic was listen to women, simple, and somebody had written slap the hoes, and so I went back up and put slap the hosers, and that kind of thing is reminiscent of what it is like with Facebook,
right.
And using those tools to, you know, like, have fun, and like, be controversial, and
yeah.
Get conversations going,
yeah.
I like it,
yeah.
That's, I guess, sort of what you were talking about, too.
So I think we're probably at a point where we could maybe do one more piece, if you want to, or we'll probably close down the conversation soon, so I don't completely tire and exhaust you guys, because you've been really, really generous. And I know it takes a lot to to do this, especially before my talk. But would you like to just ease it out with conversation, or do you want to do another piece, or how do you feel, whatever, whatever is good?
I can do another piece.
Okay. Okay. Do you want the mic this
time? No, I'm good.
Okay.
The one that I'll do is like on my MySpace. It's been there forever, and it's actually my favorite piece that I have.
I hope it's the one.
But it doesn't. It's not really complicated. It's about conjugal violence and about how it's very difficult to leave a situation when you're in experiencing this, and you have how it kind of creeps up on you and you assume that it will either get better or just go away. And I think I'm doing all this explaining beforehand. I wrote it with that conjugal violence in mind, and I think it goes a lot with any kind of oppression. Like, how, I think Ian was actually mentioning something like that, like, you just really have to call it like it is and step on it,
mm-hmm.
or it's just going to creep in everywhere and just take it. It's called battery. In case of fire, leave quickly and quietly. You will find yourself drawn to things. Do not stop. The smoke may make you sleepy. Do not yield yourself or your children. The flame that started low and hot in the corner, the one through which you thought you might sleep, to wake and find it had diminished or disappeared, will in fact have risen to eat you alive. Do not look directly into its eye. Don't let on your leaping. If you must bring things, pile them quickly and haphazard into black bags like you're going to the trash. Hide your most precious jewels in your hair or between your teeth. Forget the photographs. They will only bring you pain when the house is burnt down to powdered black ash. Bring the deed to your house. It will serve as remembrance for what once was. Under no circumstances must you tell the children there is a fire, for they will cry and want to cling to their beds, to the house. And lastly, and just in case, concerning the children, commit their faces to memory. Every turn, every corner, every line.
I feel like we need to talk again rather than going into one more performance. Anybody have any more questions? Last chance. Are all of you from, well, I know you're from the States. Is everybody here from, otherwise from Canada? No? Are you from the States too?
No, I'm from England.
From England. Because I was trying to, or explaining to our performers that I was really new to performance studies as an organization, and that it is an international group, but maybe you can actually help me with that. But is it an organization that began in England then, or the UK? Do you know?
Performance Studies International.
And do you know where it started?
It's the first time that I've
New York
City.
It's come to the last person to ask.
Okay. So it's from the States.
Apparently.
And it's about 20 years old, something like that. Okay.
Here.
And it's the first time it's been in Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last one was in Zagreb, and this is in one Aberystwyth, and you guys know what else. It moves around the world every year.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here.
It's wonderful. So, Alida, how do you feel? No pressure to perform. Did you want to, or should I thank everybody?
I don't really know what to say to that
question.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's
definitely.
Yeah.
Can
we vote?
You know we all want it.
Okay. I just feel like sometimes I just watch the pace in a room sometimes, but we're all actually secretly hoping that you're going to say yes.
Okay.
So you're just trying not to put pressure on me.
Okay.
I'm going to read something newish then that I've been kind of working on to try to get it really, like, to get it better. So this is called Irish Swamps, and this came from, I released a book of poetry a year and a half ago, and I noticed as soon as I started mentioning in my bio that my father is Native, that whenever I was in festivals, I would go from being on the main stage to being on the side, tiny stage over, oh, we'll put you and all the other Indians in the corner there. And it really upset me. And I was really able to see the shape of it from performing prior to revealing my bright brownness to concealing it. In my family, it's not something we really talk about with pride. We talk about it through lots and lots of alcohol and fights. And so we don't really, my dad didn't grow up being told that it was a good thing to be Indian in this country. So this is called Irish Swamps. I am a natural hot spring. My water wells up, then dries out. It ebbs and flows with memories about rushing for years at a time, or seconds of light explosions. My DNA illuminates this world to me like, whoop, wow, check it out. I see Germany through one side of my gray-eyed poppy. Hey, look, I eat sauerkraut. My German genes still pop out. I mohawk against Ireland. My jersey changes daily. I'm noble, brave, and Gaelic fairy. Hazel-eyed till you get to know me, then watch how war comes up through me. I'm wampum belts, industrial machinery, monarch butterflies, I migrate seamlessly. I'm Irish swamps at nighttime, soldiers fighting bravely. I am British artillery from Hudson's Bay to New York State. Love and war and fucking, boats and battles, sex and hate. I'm cedar canoes, I'm gone into hiding, I'm in another territory's riding. Then one split second later, I've gone to meet my grandma's maker. We're in the bingo line again, dusting photos in Port Elgin. We dodge questions of Mohawk origin, let's keep this family's secrets hidden. I'm sweetgrass at my own funeral, Celtic tunes on a penny whistle. I'm aurora borealis, barefoot and I'm savage. I'm earthquakes and paralysis, soft quartz crystal, black, pink, and gray. I'm earth spinning round, becoming me.
Well, this was an amazing time for me. Thank you very much. I'm so glad that I've got to know the three of you and that I've got to share it with all of you. And I just wonder if we can give another applause to thank you.